Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Had a feeling you'd be here! The cycles haven't been timed, have they?
Oh, you don't look so bad.
I did everything! Everything you ever asked!
I know you did.
I executed the plan!
As you saw it.
You promised that we would change the world together. You broke your promise, I know.
I understand that.
I took the system to its maximum potential. I created the perfect system!
The thing about perfection is that it's unknowable. It's impossible, but it's also right in front of us all the time. You wouldn't know that because I didn't when I created you. I'm sorry, Clue. I'm sorry.
A culminating scene from Tron Legacy, where Flynn confronts his digital twin and algorithmic shadow, Clue, the demiurge of the virtual reality universe known as the Grid. Perfection is the argument. Can it be achieved, or is Flynn right? We'll get into that shortly. First, please allow me to introduce myself. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your Pompidus of Gnosis. Welcome to the Desert of the Real. Welcome to Aeon Byte. We don't take prisoners but liberate them. We are not the final authority on anything but hope to be an endless possibility for everything. You are the final authority, have always been. Divided we stand, together we rise. This may not be the best time to be alive, but it's the best time to be awake. Even as the Archons fight against the inner man, as the Nag Hammadi Library says. Eternity hasn't gone anywhere these last few years. It's still there for your taking. It's your birthright as a child of Hermes, the god of thieves, and Sophia, the goddess of smugglers.
Do not try and bend the spoon. That's impossible. Instead, only try to realize the truth.
What truth?
There is no spoon.
There is no spoon?
Then you'll see that it is not the spoon that bends, it is only yourself.
This quote by Philip K. Dick explains a lot. Today we live in a society in which spurious realities are manufactured by the media, by governments, by big corporations, by religious groups, political groups. So I ask, in my writing, what is real? Because unceasingly, we are bombarded with pseudo-realities manufactured by very sophisticated people using very sophisticated electronic mechanisms. I do not distrust their motives. I distrust their power. They have a lot of it, and it is an astonishing power, that of creating whole universes, universes of the mind. I ought to know. I do the same thing.
There's a beauty to this world, an order. That's what we like to believe. We're not wrong. There is an order, a grand design. We made sure of that. It was a dream for so long, and we finally made it real. Not a better world, a perfect one.
Thanks for laying your cards on the table. Also, demiurgic man in black from Westworld. And cool quote, Phil. I know you're urging us to write our own gospel and live our own myth. urge us to create better than the creator gods and their Karens and Kadamites in the establishment. To imagine freer worlds and deeply understand the narrative of the cosmos, its archetypal images and symbolical energies and mythic resonances that have been used against us for millennia. Those in power want to create for us a universe of pods and bugs and owning nothing and fake plastic trees. Instead, we will create a universe of innovation and compassion, one devoid of any type of slavery or bigotry. Yes, we will. And I'm glad you're here with me, you shining crazy diamonds. For this universe of the mind is also the end of all utopias from the men in black.
What the ancient Hebrews were to Egypt and the early Christians were to Rome, we are now to this corrupt new American empire. It's an ancient fight, Nick. The values of the individual against the supremacy of the state.
Certainly, to create a better universe, a better universe of the mind. A theme of this show this year has been to uncover the suppressed secrets of the land. Connect with the trickster spirits and forgotten goddesses of the woods. We'll have more shows in the future on arcane North America. Yet in this eternal now, we focus on Finland, an overlooked landscape of portals and ancient pagan magic. A country that interacted in transformative ways with Theosophy, Gurdjieff, Thelema, Freemasonry, and occult Nazism.
This is blasphemy! This is madness!
And much more, and in ways that will help us understand better Western esotericism in general. The focus comes from the book, Lightbringers of the North, Secrets of the Occult Tradition of Finland. Our astral guest is one of the work's authors, Vesa Liti. Any of you D&D players ever had a huge crush on Iluvjatar in the Deities and Demigods Finnish Mythos section? And yes, I should also ask about Olivia Wilde in Tron Legacy. Woof woof.
Mr. Garrison, Wendy and I think that was a sexist statement.
Just checking. And anyhow, don't check out for a fascinating book and a fascinating interview.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Back to perfection. To that Tron Legacy speech on perfection. I say that Plato is history's first technocratic eugenicist, as seen in his work, The Republic. Scholar Mark O'Brien once said that's not Plato's worst idea. It was his concept of perfection. Once Plato rolled out the world of ideas or forms, the notion of the one or monad being a static, unmoving blob of flawlessness, it crippled Western man's psyche.
It was a disaster. The perfect world was a dream that your primitive cerebrum kept trying to wake up from.
The bar was raised too high for both a god to be and a mortal to achieve. I mean, what the hell is perfection anyway? Look at Yahweh, a storm angel who was only interested in playing in the desert and taking care of his people. Almost overnight, dude was elevated to being omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient. Why? Why should any divine being be perfect? When divinity is simply a transcendental attribute and being part of the flow of a higher existence. Be perfect like your heavenly father became a choking mantra that stifled the elegant messiness of alchemical growth and expanded consciousness.
The experience of the eternal.
That's what you are.
Yes.
I would say.
That whatever eternity is here right now.
And nowhere else, or everywhere else.
The bar wasn't just raised too high, it was impossible to reach because it doesn't exist. Or at least it doesn't lend to the loving but chaotic courtship that is reaching oneness with all of existence. As author Shannon Alder said, "There is no perfection, only beautiful versions of brokenness."
Junkies and masochists and hookers and those who have squandered everything are the ring of brightest angels around heaven.
The ground of being shouldn't be in some lofty frozen dimension next to the stupid ideal form of a chair or something. Instead, the ground of being should be on the dirty ground with the grimy tears of wisdom and the despised philosopher's stone buried in the mud. Jason Reza Giorgiani said that Ahura Mazda was not omnipotent or omniscient. Just being the main emitter of light and wisdom was enough to make him supreme in a dark universe.
All that is visible must grow beyond itself and extend into the realm of the invisible.
So screw the one, or more like the one interpreted by those seeking power, those writing the narrative of this universe. Let's instead embrace the God in the gutter of Philip K. Dick.
Your heart is pure. The broken are the more evolved.
The Gnostics at least didn't buy fully into this notion of perfection. The All, or the Pleroma, as is written in Secret John, encompasses everything and is in everything. A gradient of imagination that was part of an astral noetic river of revelation. The Pleroma was pure, liberating information that couldn't be bothered with omnipotence or any other features of matter. The Gnostics use apophatic theology, keen koans, and mythopoeia to tell us that we were meant to organically experience the Pleroma, the All, dance with the numinous until we melted into an essence of love and holy silence.
The quest is to be liberated from the negative, which is really our own will to nothingness. And once having said yes to the instant, the affirmation is contagious. It bursts into a chain of affirmations that knows no limit. To say yes to one instant is to say yes to all of existence.
In some texts, like Marsanis, there is even a God above God above God. So perhaps spiritual evolution never ends, and you just keep growing, keep adventuring, because at the end of the eternity, it's just so dang fun.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained? Is this not why you are here?
That's the message of Flynn and Tron Legacy. We are still in the grid with the Demiurge or Man in Black, however. So let's not worry about perfection and continue writing a new narrative with our interview with Vesa.
Not a better world. A perfect one.
And you can come along too, Yahweh. We need to get you back to your old position and find your wife, Ashira.
The grid. A digital frontier. I tried to picture clusters of information as they move through the computer. What did they look like? Ships, motorcycles. Were the circuits like freeways? I kept dreaming of a world I thought I'd never see. And then, one day, I got in.
This is the Aeon Byte interview. And with us, we have the pleasure of being joined by Vesa Ite to discuss his book, Lightbringers of the North, Secrets of the Occult Tradition of Finland. Vesa, how are you doing?
Doing good, thank you. Honored to be here on your show.
Thank you very much. The honor is all ours. And with us, too, we've got the light bringer of California, the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. Boy, those are big shoes to walk in California. But it's not often that we hear from those up north there. So this should be very interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, this would be the second one. I had the honor a couple of years ago of interviewing Aki Sederberg. Know him, right, Vesa? I love his work.
Absolutely. Aki is a good friend of mine. And as you said, his work is great. Like Journeys in Kali Yuga is awesome book. And also his new book, Pyha Eurooppa, Holy Europe, that is coming in English sometime in near future. It's a great book as well. So if somebody has liked Aki's work, his next book is something to look forward to as well.
Oh, I agree. I definitely would love to have a chat with him. Yeah, his book, Journeys in the Kali Yuga, the way his adventures in India and connecting the East and the West and the traditions of Finland, just and a lot of beautiful poetic prose that he puts in his work. Very good stuff. So
yeah.
So, but you've done also a great job yourself with this book, which gives such a new light, brings a lot of light to the rich tradition of occultism and esoterica in Finland. So maybe let's start with you. Tell us about yourself. How did you become interested in these topics, and what led you to writing Lightbringers of the North?
Oh, that's a long story. I try to put it short. I've been interested in these topics like since a very early age, and I've been myself involved in different kind of groups throughout the years. I'm pretty private when it comes to my own practice, but been involved with this and that. Maybe I could say that since the early 2002 or so, I've been involved with the local Gurdjieff group, and daily meditation has been my practice like since 2015, I have a master's degree in comparative religion, so I've study wise too, like I've been digging this field. And when it comes to our book, it came out Valonkantajat in original Finnish. It came in 2015. It was a huge success. It's now in its fourth Finnish print, and there is also a Finnish audiobook available. It was a big success. The second print of the Finnish version went into printers already like after 2 weeks. The first edition had been out, and we got lots of coverage in national, all kinds of media. The book inspired like a local occult walking tours in Turku and Helsinki, and one theater play in Oulu, northern part of the country. And the Perttu Häkkinen, a dear friend of mine who unfortunately passed away 2018 in a bicycle accident, he approached me about the book in 2013 when I was at this book affair in Helsinki talking about my translation of Gianni de Saltzman's The Reality of Being. And he approached me about this idea. He had this idea that because there is no like a popular history work of this area in Finnish, like between one book's covers, like the general view of what has happened in our country when it comes to occult esotericism, like why wouldn't we write it? He was familiar with my previous like books and translations I had done, and I had a quite popular blog back then that I wrote, and he really liked the touch that I have and the sense of humor. He sensed that we have a very similar approach, and so he thought that this might be a great thing to do with me. I wasn't initially so like sure, like what to think of that. Is it a good idea or not, or so? And a few months passed, and he approached me again, and we talked more about it. And then I warmed up to the idea that, hey, this is actually a nice idea. And this this guy, we get very well along and have similar kind of approach and sense of humor. So, yeah, let's go for it. And we started to, well, build the structure of the book, and we got the book deal very quickly. And from there it went. And it was very important to Perttu that the book would also be published in English. And when the Finnish edition came out, he immediately started to nudge me friendly that, hey, maybe you could translate our book too, because we didn't have funding for get somebody else professionally translate the book into English. It's not that cheap. And he knew that I had translated some works earlier, so he thought that I could do it. We could save the money. And but I was busy with other things, and I kind of felt like that I need the break from this now, and we can return to it later. But then this sad thing happened in 2018. Perttu passed away, and I remembered the thing still, and I got this feeling that this is a matter of honor, honoring his work. Perttu worked for a national radio. He was a kind of a light bringer himself. Esotericism, occult topics, things like that were a regular theme in his national radio show. And so it was a matter of honoring his work and also his will in general about getting this book out that he considered very highly. And he often referred our book that it's an important part of our great work, to use Aleister Crowley's terms. And so I thought that I need to do this, because I had a feeling if I don't translate it, maybe nobody will. And I know the book very well. I knew it, and I knew Perttu and the touch we had to the book. I thought that if I leave it for somebody later to translate, there are chances that it don't get so well done as we both would have wanted. So I decided that, okay, that's it. Also, I had also, Perttu came to my dreams a few times after he passed away, still reminding me that this is important. This needs to be finished. So there it is. And I contacted Inner Traditions, John Graham, who Perttu had initially contacted already, I think 2015, 2016. And the discussion continued, and I got the deal for the book, and the process started and continued, and now the book is finally out there. It's great.
Well, wonderful. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, I read, I finished the book yesterday, and I was sad about Perttu. We hope your book definitely honors him. We hope to honor him in the show. It's interesting because Perttu in Portuguese means close by. And I was thinking this morning, I put on Facebook a picture of my 10-year-old daughter in her ballet recital. She's doing very well. And one of my aunts is like, your mother would be so proud. And I'm like, no, she is proud. They haven't gone anywhere. The dead just speak a different language, right? They come in our dreams, symbols. Right. They're still around, and the moment has never ended. So Perttu is still, he's still enjoying it, and he's part of the whole thing, right?
Absolutely. I agree.
I mean, if we don't, you know, we in the cult sometimes don't eat our own dog food, right? We act like Protestants or Catholics when the going gets tough, when we realize we're seeped in this the esoterica.
Right.
So good deal. Well, speaking of the esoterica, and you do deal with this in your book, you talk about, what exactly is Western esotericism? Because as you write, most people think that the Western mystery tradition or Western esoterica is simply sort of Gnostic, Hermetic, and Neoplatonic theology filtered through Renaissance magicians and then sort of couched in Protestant ideology, and then a lot of times it ignores paganism, it rejects New Age. I mean, maybe tell the audience what exactly is esotericism, because it's important to know this when, you know, you're talking about all these subjects in your book.
Right. Yeah. It's before the first chapter, we go through definitions of terms, like what is esotericism, what is occult, and all of these things. Well, this is a deep topic, and when it comes to like academic definitions of these terms, looking at the history of how this discussion has been handled, like the meaning of the words have changed a bit, and there's never been consensus. Like also nowadays, there's like a not like a firm exact definition, what it exactly means, what it exactly it contains, basically it could be said that I try to put this a bit maybe black and white clearly, that esotericism, it can be said to mean that it means a kind of rejected knowledge, kind of literally esoteric from Greek, it means something inside, something inner, and it refers to like a deeper knowledge of universe, of what is in there, that is and it involves a kind of idea of gnosis, knowledge, this kind of knowledge of a deeper understanding of the universe. It's something that available for a kind of selected few, those initiated into some tradition. It's transmitted from a person, from teachers to students or a group to the students. And there are certain ways how this knowledge is transmitted. And as such, it is like opposite of esotericism is exoteric. Like what one can read from New York Times or or listen to from this podcast. This is more kind of exoteric, although we are talking about esoteric ideas. But exoteric means something that is open to anybody. It's basically all there in the public to access if you are interested. So esotericism is something that is like for a selected few, for those initiated. It's a kind of a hidden knowledge. It's there. Occultism, these things, these words are quite like overlapped. They refer to similar kind of things, but I think occultism, it's more general term. It refers in general like a hidden knowledge, hidden like a wisdom. It kind of can refer to any kind of like a practice that is done like in this kind of magical ways, and it can involve all kind of things, alchemy and astrology, all kind of things. It's more vague, if you will. But if you ask from some scholar, they might disagree, and another scholar might more or less agree, and they would have a different kind of viewpoints. But this I would say kind of a basic rough take on what is esotericism, what is occultism, occult. And there earlier before I answered, there was a point about what is Western esotericism in a Western studies of Western esotericism. This came from this Antoine Fabre. I probably pronounced the man's name wrong, but he had a very important role in how Western esotericism or esotericism in general has been defined, and he had very exact requirements what can be considered to be within the realm of esotericism. And in his definition, there were things that left out from the definition, things like modern paganism and influences from Eastern, things like Hinduism, yoga, and all these kind of things. So these things leave, and they are a matter of definition. So they change.
Oh yeah, I do like Antoine Favre. I'm sure I'm butchering his name too, since it's French. Yeah. But he talks about four innate characteristics that define these currents of esotericism.
Yep.
And
yep.
One is the idea of correspondence. Obviously, mm-hmm. Hermes, as above, so below. The right. idea of nature as a living whole. That would mm-hmm. include paganism. Mm-hmm. Importance of imagination and some spiritual idea of being as a medium mm-hmm. for communication on the path to spiritual insight. The inner world, which of course you find in the East, you find in Greek Orthodoxy, and then for the goal of transmutation. So I think that's right. a good one, because that one you can certainly include, like you said, pagan traditions, you can include the East. You know, Aki can say, yes, the Hindu sadhu is the same as the Russian shaman. They're both looking for the same. And this definition or characteristics work for these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In addition to these 4 points, there are also two relative traits, like special ways to transmit knowledge, like a teacher-student relationship or a group and student. And then there's also this kind of harmonious consideration of different philosophies. And the point of this was to find a common ground behind different traditions. I think this is this philosophia perennis concept points to that deep there is a kind of a common ground, right. like ontological reality, which is shared through different kind of traditions. And so but you summarize very well those 4 points.
Thank you. Yeah, well, it's in your book, straight out of the horse's mouth, I suppose. And the audience might also know, before we really delve into your book, what exactly was Finland before Christ came along? And I'm sure Christ came very peacefully with his followers, right? Very peacefully, right?
When it comes to history of Finland, like what it was like around year zero, we were this very little known pocket here in the north that not too many people knew that much. We started to become part of Sweden, or under Sweden's influence in the 12th century, and that continued till the 1809. Then we became part of Russia, which was from 1809 till 1917, when we became independent. Before Christian's arrival, we had, of course, like the kind of nature-based religion. Up in the north, there was this shamanistic tradition fairly strong among the Sami people, and more in the east of the country, I would say that there was probably this kind of a verbal magic tradition stronger. But these are kind of things I'm not exactly sure, but at least later this kind of emphasizes in areas was there. But anyway, it was a very naturally oriented spiritual area. And Christianity arrived here like pretty much elsewhere, like we know what it is.
We know what happened.
yeah
But I think wasn't one of the you might say game-changing events was the Kalevala being published in 1835, that sort of gave this Finnish epic account of the gods and their hero Väinö Nomin. That really changed things too. And I must say, that I knew of the Kalevala in Finnish mythology, because of all places, it was used to be part of the Dungeons and Dragons thing. As a somebody of my age, Dungeons and Dragons was very important, and the Finnish mythos was a big deal. So we would use the gods and all that. But but again, that changed. It really gave your country a sense of belonging and pride, and looked into the past.
Right, right. If I go a little bit backwards to the time of Christianity, a funny anecdote. The first official documents about Finland is a papal bull from the Pope of the time. I think this was from the 12th century. The note was to Archbishop of Uppsala, Sweden. We were under Swedish rule then. The name of the letter, the bull, was called Gravis ad modum, which means very serious. And the contents of that letter was that Finns are happy to get the help that the church gives to it in times of need. But when things are going well, Finns blaspheme the God and the church and Christianity in general, and they make fun of it, and they persecute the priest and so forth. And because of this, Finns are twice the children of hell. And to this day, Vatican haven't taken its words back.
You're like the Cathars.
Yeah, anyway, but back to Kalevala. Yeah, like 1835, the first edition of the book came out. And yes, it was very important when it comes to the raising feeling of national identity. This intensified during that century, and by the late 19th century, it was really getting bigger and bigger. And of course, having your own national epic, that's a big thing. That's a big thing. It's you're proud of your own language, your own culture in many ways. You have your own, this book, national epic, that tells the myths and the stories, and have this a national mythic hero, Väinämöinen, the main hero of the book, and all these other characters and great stories. So we are a great nation among others. We have our own national epic, and it had a very, very big role. The book was collected by this Lönnrot from the eastern part of Finland, from the Pohjois-Karjala area, northern Karelia. Largely this area is now on the Russian side, but back then it was still part of Finland. And he collected this and put together into this book. We have a very, very rich archives in general about this kind of a folk poetry and folk ideas, pre-Christian ideas of a lot of different kind of moods and supernatural beings and all of that, and how to deal with these different realms of reality and, well, basically magical ideas. And so maybe the first important work in this way to be mentioned was by Christfried Genander, who lived from 1741 till 1790. He wrote this book called Mythologica Fennica, which first time told about these things. And there are other works, of course, too, that has been of importance. And still today, these things inspire, especially those people who fall into the neo-pagan category. These things are of especially inspiration for them, but for other people too. But back to Kalevala, it was a big thing, and of course it's a national epic still today. It's of great importance to Finns.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Yes, indeed. There is one part of your book you're talking about the Kalevala, how it was an impact already in the 19th century. So, of course, you've got somebody in the Theosophical Society. I don't know if it might have been Blavatsky or Annie Besant, but of course, had to say that the people of the Kalevala were connected to, surprise, Atlantis. So it had to be Atlantis, right?
Yeah, there is this this link there too. Yeah, right. But already beginning from Pekka Ervast, who's a character of the first chapter, he was the man who was, you could say, responsible, really bringing Theosophical Society and Theosophical thinking, philosophy to Finland. He was deeply inspired by Kalevala and its mythical worldview and heroes as well. So it was already there. And going through the decades after that, there can be, we can find other persons and groups that have been inspired by it still. Yeah.
Yeah, Rekka Ervast, he said, I think it was 1918, I have the notes here, he said that Vainioman actually spoke to him and guided him to continue the occultism. So same thing that happens in all religions, you know, some great being speaks through us, you know?
Yeah. He Ervast was born 1875, died 1934. He was quite humble man, like a very honest spiritual seeker. You could say that he never got pee in his head. His ego didn't get big when he became more and more famous and so. But at some point, he felt like that he has a message from Vainamoinen, the main hero of Kalevala, the national epic, and it was a difficult thing for him to bring this forth to Finnish members of Theosophical Society that, hey, I actually have this kind of message. but he did, and apparently there was something in there, because it all played out, I guess, pretty well.
Yeah, it's always better when you've got one of the big guns talking through you, whether it's Jesus, Muhammad, Vainamoinen, you know, you'll get more done, more people will listen to you, of course.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, he was one of the pioneers to bring the Theosophical Society to Finland. He was in Helsinki, but he also had sort of a friction, right, when Besant and Leadbeater were trying to bring the savior of the world, Krishnamurti, and all that. He did not like that pivot from the Theosophical Society.
Yes. There was, of course, this kind of inner schisms within Theosophical Society in general. And of course, Ervast became part of it too, because he was a head of the society in Finland. Typical to Ervast, he was very diplomatic, and he tried to remind others in the society that, hey, we are really all about brotherhood and these spiritual ideas. We shouldn't fight about political things or this kind of power play within our own society or society in general. So Ervas was this kind
of... Did he break away from the Theosophical Society? Did he stick it through?
Eventually, yes. He wanted to found inside Finnish Theosophical Society a kind of occult branch, but this didn't get much support. And he and those that supported him back then got annoyed. And then they break away from Theosophical Society, and Ervast founded his own organization, Ruusuristi, which can be translated as Rose Cross. And he continued with that. He also brought, was very important in bringing to Finland this Ledroit Humain Freemasonry, which is the type of Freemasonry that also accepts women as members. So it was, he was very important in this too. This happened before he founded his Ruusuristi own organization. But yeah, he eventually broke away from Theosophical Society because of different views and that his ideas didn't get support that he was looking for.
Fascinating. Yeah, and going back to the Kalevala, maybe you could tell the audience about Väinänen, because I was reading, yes, he's this great warrior, but he also goes into the underworld, like mm-hmm. Gilgamesh and Orpheus and all mm-hmm. Hercules, all these heroes seem to go down into the underworld, the great, you know, going down into the unconscious. But
yeah.
So how would you parallel Väinämöinen to other heroes, or what makes him unique, or what archetypal image does he represent? Who is this guy?
He's the main national mythical hero of Finland. He is this great hero who is able to...
He's mortal or demigod?
That's a matter of definition. Yeah, demigod is probably quite close. He has these amazing occult powers, of course. And as you said, he's able to travel between this world and the underworld and bring knowledge from there. And he has this amazing... poem singing skills that he can use this kind of verbal magic, knowing the root causes of things. He can use this singing, this verbal magic to cause all kind of things. And he can be compared, like you said, to other kind of mythical figures. There are definitely,
so he's not just similarities. A powerful warrior, he's a shaman, a poet, a bard. He's like the Renaissance man, if you
will. right exactly. I'm like say that yeah, he has this kind of warrior skill too, but if one reads through the book, he's not really like a warrior, like that's not so emphasized. I would say he's more shaman. It's about it's about just keeping the defending his group and doing good for it. Like it's not so much about doing battle, like a battle against other groups or so in the war sense. But there is, of course, this battle or this tension in Kalevala stories between this Pohjola and this. This evil figure, and who they try to steal this Sampo, this kind of wonder mill, and so. But Kalevala has not been like a use as much as a book to like a boost your moral in battle, like some other national epics maybe. It's a more, you could say, like a more peaceful, maybe, although there are this kind of battle and this kind of confrontational elements. But yeah.
Oh, well, wonderful. Well, maybe it's good. You don't want Marvel to come out and make a movie out of this stuff and chief somebody must.
Yeah. With this, then yeah, I'd be wondering every now and then, like when somebody is going to make this into a movie and who is going to play Väinämöinen. So. I'm afraid.
yeah. Let's wait. But I mean, the Indians, the Chinese do great epics these days mm-hmm. with their national stories and their myths. So, mm-hmm. and so yeah, the technology's there and the good writing is there. So hopefully, it'll be good. And Vance, what do you think so far? Do you have any questions?
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this. It's the first time I've heard of any of it. And I was wondering about, you know, if there were influences from, you know, nearby Sweden or Germany to the south or other places, or is this totally native? you know, the story of the Kalevala? Or did the Kalevala influence other countries? Did, you know, the story seep out to the surrounding areas?
Good question. This is not exactly in my area of expertise, but of course, when it comes to how this kind of folk stories, myths, poetry is created, nothing happens in vacuum. There is a cultural influence from a surrounding areas, and you can see these influences there. But at the same time, there is something like a unique to this area. There is, of course, like you can see similarities between Väinämöinen and Odin and so forth. It's not something that that there would be just like that, something you can't find from anywhere else, this kind of elements. There are lots of common things. I lost my thought. What was your question?
Oh, I was just wondering about the relationship of the world of the Kalevala to, you know, other mythologies. And for example, you know, we know that the Greek and the Roman gods were very closely coupled. You know, the Romans pretty much copied it. But it doesn't seem to me on first hearing that, you know, the characters in the Kalevala are that closely coupled to even the, you know, the other Scandinavian mythology that, you know, we in the West are subject to. And, or, you know, European, like we know about Thor and Loki and Odin and all that stuff, but somehow, you know, it's the Kalevala characters haven't seeped into us as deeply. So I'm wondering if that implies that there's not as tightly coupled a connection. Even there are correspondences between, you know, Thor, Loki, Odin, and everybody, and the Greek and Roman gods, that they're closer correspondences. So I was wondering if you had a comment on that.
There have been lots of speculation about this, like what would these characters be in a Roman mythology or Scandinavian mythology. And so there are some similarities here and there, but it's not like a super, like a clear that, all right, like a this correspondence to this and so, but maybe Väinämöinen is the most easiest one to put like see similarities between some characters. This has been a topic of a lots of speculation and talk throughout the year, and from our book too, like it's possible to find. There was this guy in the chapter about occultism, nationalism, like the Sigurd Bettenhovi Aspa, born 1870, died 1946. He draw like similarities between characters of Kalevala to gods of Egypt, ancient Egypt, and all these wild things.
And Atlantis, let's not forget Atlantis.
Oh, yeah. Aspa was one of those who saw similarities, like clearly, like without doubt, here and there. But there is something unique in Kalevala. Like I can't, like this is not my area of expertise, but I would say that if somebody's interested, find a copy, easy to find nowadays, and it's a great book, just as a mythical story, and there are good English translations, so I very much recommend, if somebody's interested, just go and find it and read it. It's great.
Fantastic.
Yeah, sounds like, yeah, very rich tradition. And well, going back to the esoterica, I'm sure people want to know, as always, our other favorite, or perhaps everybody's favorite villain for the last 100 years, are the occult Nazis. How did Nazism affect Finland occultism? Obviously, as you write in your book, there was plenty of you know, white nationalists, weird people that really bought into it too, right?
Yeah, there are one can find connections to National Socialist in Germany. In our book, the first person that we find in this category is It's Uri von Gröhnhagen, a nobleman born 1911, died 2003. He ended up becoming a close friend of Heinrich Himmler and Karl Maria Willigut. And because of these connections, he was sent to eastern part of Finland, this area from which the poems of Kalevala was collected from. And he was sent there by this Ahnenerbe, this SS, pseudo-scientific Nazi institute, to collect folk poetry and get this Kantele instruments for Himmler and in his involvement in all of this, Uri von Gröhnhagen, of course, witnessed all kind of things and became like a very intimately involved with Karl Maria Willigut and his wild esoteric ideas. Gröhnhagen wasn't himself like any diehard, like practitioner of these things, but he saw it very closely and he was involved. He had a very strong spiritual guess, I would say, of his own. But the first this kind of a Nazi connections in this Finnish esoteric history can be, I said, found from here. And this is, of course, at the very core of Nazi esotericism. Like, if you're close to Karl Maria Willigut, how you can get any yeah. any closer than that? Yeah. Then there were, of course, during the time of the Nazi regime, there were people who were thinking positively of the Nazi Germany politics, like the Sigurd Bettenhövi Aspa, who I mentioned already. And so then the Second World War ended, and the world after that opened. The most infamous person who was openly a neo-Nazi and an occultist at the same time was Pekka Siitonen, born 1944, died 2003. He was a very peculiar guy. He mixed politics and occultism in this very unique way. Came out in the early 70s as a neo-Nazi and at the same time devil worshipper. Not exactly a combination to get friends.
No, or votes.
He was quite something. He was generally nobody nowadays takes him seriously when it comes to as a political influence or a serious esotericist or so. But in the 70s, still, like his books and ideas, like they were taken more seriously than now, and his occult society, this Turun Hengentieteen Seura, kind of a Turku society of spiritual sciences, had a bunch of members, and they published lots of books and had meetings, and then this politics started to become more and more involved with the activities of the group, and they were not only talking, but they were really in direct action. They sent letter bombs and they did lots of threats. And yeah. In 1977-78, things escalated to such a point that one of the more mentally unstable members of Siitonen society tried to explode this Kursiivi, this communist printing house. And that was a huge national scandal. The place was burned badly, and so the bomb didn't detonate, but it was serious, and he got a prison sentence for that, and some other members of the group, and after that he was more quiet, but still continued to talk about, well, both politics and occultism, and he really continued with both of these things till his death. And the story goes that his last wife told that Siitonen, still on his deathbed, that he was crying for help from Lucifer, that he could get healed and all of that stuff. But Siitonen was, it's very difficult to describe. He was so bizarre character, and but in the book we go very, very throughout the basics of his life and go also a bit deeper. So it's all there. And it's odd. It's a kind of funny, horrifying at the same time.
Yeah.
And he makes his own very peculiar mix of politics and theosophy and homespun devil worship, all of this.
So he thinks God is a communist, I guess, right?
Yeah, he didn't think very warmly of them. There are other persons too, like who fall within this connection with Nazis and occultism, like we write in this chapter about occultism, nationalism. There is especially this Väinö Kuisma, who tried to cooperate with Seaton at some point, but it didn't really work out. Nowadays, there is none of these guys really around, but when it comes to recent groups that somehow somebody might link to these Nazi groups, there is this kind of, you could say, left-hand path organization or Satanist organization called Black Order of Pan-Europe. They have these links with this Order of Nine Angles and all of that very infamous stuff. And they are not just esoteric or magical, but they at least want to look like that they are politically active in the world too. And apparently there is something in that. So this undercurrent kind of threat in the story is there too, but it's not that big though.
Yeah, but it's still fascinating how you describe these characters in your book. And in World War II, Finland was neutral, right?
We we tried to be neutral. At some point of the war, we were a small country. We are a small country between Russia, who is our eastern neighbor. We have a very long borderline with them. So of course, they were influencing us a lot. But then at some point, we needed help against Russia. And there was Nazi Germany, and Finland allied with Nazi Germany for a period of time. They came with their Stukas to help on the Eastern Front, and what the military power they brought here. And then things changed again. And that went down, and Nazis left Finland and burned Lapland. And
oh, wow.
and so we tried to be quite neutral, but it's difficult in situations like that. So for some period of time, we were allied with Nazis, but that was only for right. a part of the time, and only because we had really no choice.
Yeah. I mean, you had Stalin. I mean, you were, yep. Finland was part of the Russian Empire, and then the Soviets came and kind of forgot about Finland or let Finland stay. But I'm sure even today, I'm sure Finland is always like, when are the Russians going to come for us? Not if, but when, right?
It's, we became independent in 1917. And after that, of course, during the Second World War, we had the Winter War and Continuation War. And although those things are they didn't happen during the last decade, but more far away anyway, they are historically considering quite close, and these kind of things don't fade away easily from national memory. So it's there. And of course, in today's situation, all these old kind of memories, especially for older people, they are there, and this potential threat is there. Yeah,
that's history for you. And as you write in your book, Vesa, during the Tsarist Russia time period, Freemasonry was banned.
Right.
But once the Soviets took over and Finland was able to become independent, then what Freemasonry beyond L'Adroit Humain was able to really enter into Finland?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how it went. After 1917, it was all right again publicly to run Freemasonry here, and the traditional type of Freemasonry was resurrected here. And then at the same time, or actually a bit earlier than that, this Ledroy Tumine type of Freemasonry arrived as well. So yeah, it was dormant, like about for 100 years here, because it became banned. But I'm sure there was a kind of underground activity by ex-Masons and people involved during that dormant 100 years. And there were other kind of secret societies during that time too, that can be seen from the newspapers of that time, or kind of interesting occult society popping up here and there. And they were clearly at least influenced by Freemasons, if not run by people who were involved. So yeah, that's how it went. Nowadays, like elsewhere, they are of course still there and have a fairly big number of members. And like elsewhere in Europe and in the States, they have lots of pretty famous people in politics and other positions of power. And of course, of that, they also like got this controversies every now and then, that they are involved in this and that and so. But based on all the research, like really good academic research and so, like as we know, this is basically nonsense. But these things go as they go.
It doesn't matter the country; it's the same,
yeah.
Same wacky Satanist, same Freemason rumors. Yeah, nothing changes. Every country is
got
their same thing. And if people want to get to know you more, where they can find out more about you, Vesa, website, anything else like that?
I would say the best place is to find us from Facebook. If you search the Lightbringers of the North, you will find the books page. And well, we have a Instagram page as well. Both places have pictures related to the book. Most of them are in color. In the book, they are in black and white. From those pages, you can find them in color. There is also some extra stories and links and all that kind of stuff. So if somebody is interested to contact me about the book, or just find more about the characters and stories, both of those pages are good places to go. And of course, like the book itself can be found from the internet, from many bookstores online, and it's very well I've understood also available as a physical copy from regular bookstores. So
awesome.
Yeah, that's it.
I'll have something in the show notes. And yes, the book can be purchased from the good people at Inner Traditions. I love that publisher. They will publish everything that's esoteric, no matter how controversial or niche or forgotten. They're always pumping up. And I'm very happy that they put out this book, because, again, it's a very overlooked and rich tradition. And I hope it continues. So, But we are at the end, Vesa. Thank you very much for coming on the show. And good luck with all your projects and everything else.
Thank you so much. It was absolutely an honor to be on your show.
Honor was all ours. And thank you again for coming on.
Thank you.
And there you have it, my beloved True Seekers, the first part of our interview with Vesa. In our second part, Vesa discusses Gurdjieff and his influence on Finland, and vice versa. Vesa will talk about UFO visitations and experiences in Finland. He'll share some amazing but disturbing stories of occult rituals and crimes in his homeland. Very graphic shit. And how some may be tied to, bum bum bum, Aleister Crowley. Then Vesa will grant us a state of the union when it comes to occultism in Finland today. Is there a pagan or esoteric revival, or is the country hopelessly falling into secularism? And much more. So please become a member for the full dope. It's only $6.99 for AB Prime members, or $4.99 at Red Circle, or whatever you want to pledge on Patreon. For AB Prime members and higher level patrons, you'll get access to my private Facebook group and Discord. If you find value in this content, please support this Red Pill Cafeteria.
Your help can be in the form of some shekel donations to PayPal or even the US mail. There is also a link on the show notes if you want to leave a tip via Stripe now. I also have the merch store and an Amazon wish list. Consider joining the Finding Hermes program, where we have bi-monthly meetings on Gnostic practices and rituals, as well as some cool Q&As. I'm also on Rockfin or Odyssey if crypto's your bag. If you need help with any of these choices, just message my ass. I'm always here to help, and I truly appreciate your help. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.